the walls they have erected to protect them from the view of the people wearing dirty rags and begging for their food, while they're serving up a banquet for the membership inside. The poor man on the bottom's contemplating suicide, 'cause he feels worthless. His hunger pains beyond belief. There's no relief. We're gonna bring back Coxie's army and take his message to the street.
That was Eddie Starr with The Return of Coxie's Army. And this is the Labor News. My name's Glenn Lang. You've all heard the story about the guy who was so stupid that he took a pocket knife to a gunfight. Yet every day, tens of millions of workers show up at their workplace and they don't have a union card in their pocket. Now, if you go into your boss's office and you look up on the wall, you'll see his union cards hanging there. He's either a member of the Chamber of Commerce or some other organization that has something to do with protecting his interests. And they protect his interests against the government, against regulation. They protect his interests against workers, against other competitors. They provide insurance for employers to provide to their employees if they're so inclined, and a number of other services. You've never been told before that that's an employer's union, but that's what it is. They do exactly the same things that a union could do for you. And these people who walk into their workplace without a union card in their pocket are committing economic suicide by doing that. Their boss may tell them that he has their interests at heart, and he may even be a nice guy, but the bottom line is that he'd send your job to China or to Bolivia or anywhere else in the world if he could get it done a little bit cheaper. That's the nature of corporate culture and business. So if he tells you that you can do better talking to him by himself, you tell him, well, then take down your union cards and abandon your unions, and I'll abandon mine. People fall for that old line all the time, but when you look around, you see more and more people getting screwed by the corporations. This United Pension default is probably the most egregious example of that. People have worked for 30 years. They were given a contract saying that they'd get the pensions that they were promised, and now they file bankruptcy and they tell the government that they have two choices: they can stay in business, or they can pay their pensions. And what does the government do? The government says, well, you can stay in business. Seems to me that if they can't take care of their obligations, they got no damn business being in business. But that's not how the government looks at it. And the reason for that is because business controls government. So now we've got all these United retirees and people who plan to retire from United who aren't going to get anything like they were promised. And yet the CEO of United was promised $4.5 million, and he's going to get all of that because, like he says, it's not a double standard. It's what he was promised. Now we've got several other companies promising to do the same thing, and the government's going to come down on the side of keeping these guys in business rather than living up to their obligations to the workers. Now, what kind of a union has that kind of clout that it can make that happen for the employers, and the workers don't have any clout whatsoever? It's time that we got up off our duffs and picked up our union cards and went out and did something about it. This United Airlines pension fund disaster is just the tip of the iceberg. But Representative George Miller of California has been having what he's been calling online hearings on the human impact of the default. And according to the Washington Post, he's quoted as saying, "We've been overwhelmed both numerically and emotionally by the response," said Miller, one of the several politicians in both parties, warning that a wider crisis will loom if the nation's pension security laws are not revised. But you and I both know they aren't going to be revised so long as the corporations get to call the shots in Washington. The corporations have been able to get themselves treated like people by getting court rulings on the 14th Amendment that give them the same rights as human beings. And, of course, the unions have not done that. So the corporations have way more rights than unions do in the eyes of the court. That's why that judge could justify ruling that all the people who worked for United for so many years could go to hell in order to keep that company in power or in business that didn't care a damn what it did to its employees. It squandered all that pension fund money, didn't make its contributions, and decided that it was just going to cut the cord and let those people drift away in order to save their pretty little butts. According to the Washington Post story, United Chief Executive Glenn Tilton testified to the Senate Finance Committee about $4.5 million he's receiving from United to replace benefits that he had accrued over a 32-year career at Texaco, his previous employer. Tilton said the default will not affect the payment, and he has $1.5 million left to collect. He said this does not represent a double standard because United promised him the money in his contract. But I got to say, United promised all those workers for so many years their retirement in contracts. Why does Tilton have standing in the people who work there for 30 years don't? Seems like seniority ought to rule there. If somebody worked for 32 years at, or 20 years or 10 years at United, they ought to be first in line ahead of Tilton to collect any pensions that might be available. But he, like the rest of these guys, always jumps to the front of the line, and anybody who tries to get caught up to him, they kick in the teeth. This is a class war, you know. The Republicans, anytime you bring up social justice, start screaming class war, class war, class war. Well, it's true, it's class war. But they only point it out when you start defending yourself. Otherwise, they're going to keep on taking and taking and taking away from working people and middle class people until we're all living in one of Charles Dickens' novels about poverty and deprivation. And there's only one way out of that, you know. You have to get organized. You have to get together. You can't walk into that workplace unarmed. It's crazy to think that you can stand up against all of that power. You're standing up against the power of the government. You're standing up against the power of big business. You're standing up against the power of the entire economy. And the only way that you're going to be able to do that is if you're holding hands with everybody else that has to do the same thing. Now, there's a lot of unions out there that you can't join unless you've got the job, you know, that it's covered by. But there's two unions for sure that you can join where you don't have to have the job first. You can join the steel workers today if you're unemployed. And you can join the IWW today even if you're unemployed. You don't need to have a job to join. I don't know how to contact the steel workers. I'll find that out. But I know that you can join the IWW by going to IWW.org and filling out a simple form and get your union card. Get it now. I want to take a minute to welcome all of our new listeners out there from all over the world. We're now on the internet, and quite a few stations are accessing the labor news. And I want to say thanks for joining us and dropping in on the conversation we've been having here for over a year in tiny little Kettle Falls, Washington. The station we broadcast on is KITR LP 101.5 here in Kettle Falls. I have an article here from inthesetimes.com entitled "The Children's Crusade: Military Programs Move into Middle Schools to Fish for Future Soldiers" by Jennifer Wedekin. And it talks about how the junior ROTC program and the Middle School Cadet Corps have gone into middle schools and enlisted kids from 11 to 14 years old into these paramilitary groups for early indoctrination into militarism. The article starts out in paragraph 1. Tarsha Moore stands as tall as her 4'8" frame will allow. Staring straight ahead, she yells out an order to a squad of peers lined up in three perfect columns next to her. Having been in the military program for 6 years, Tarsha has earned the rank of captain and is in charge of 28 boys and girls in her squad. This is Leviso Elementary School. Tarsha is 14 years old. So she's been getting indoctrinated since she was 8 years old in militarism. The article says proponents of the program tout leadership training and character development. Critics quote former Defense Secretary General William Cohen, who described the junior ROTC program as one of the best recruiting services that we could have. Rick Mills, the director of military schools and junior ROTC for the Chicago public school system, dismisses these concerns. Quote, these kinds of programs would not be in the schools if there weren't kids who wanted it, parents who supported it, and administrators who facilitated it. Well, yeah, that's true. There is a lot of militarism being peddled out there. It's peddled in the news. It's peddled in entertainment. It's peddled in games. There's no way that you're going to find somebody who hasn't been exposed to the temptations of militarism out there. So yes, there's going to be kids who want it and parents who support it, and administrators who think it's a great idea. That doesn't make it so. I think we've all told our kids, or as kids been told, if everybody else walks off a cliff, that doesn't make it a good idea. This article goes on to say that the elementary school cadet corps is a voluntary after-school program that meets two or three times a week. Programs differ from school to school, but the MSCC students generally learn first aid, civics, citizenship, and character development. They also learn military history and take field trips to local military bases. Once a week, students wear their uniforms to school for inspection. Tarsha describes buffing her uniform shoes in preparation for inspection day. Everything has to be perfect, she says. During drill practice, they learn how to stand, turn, and salute in synchronization. When they disobey an order, they do push-ups. Only 10, says one administrator. Let's see, you're taking 8, 9, and 10-year-old kids, and you're taking them to military bases, and you're teaching them military history, and that's not propaganda. But it gets even worse than that. Joanne Young is a sixth grade teacher at Goethe School in Chicago. She recently wrote a letter to the local school council protesting the implementation of the cadet corps at her school. Quote, I was told that it was not a military program, yet every aspect of it is military, she wrote. The program is training our students as young as 11 years old to march in formation and carry guns. Students could be suspended for bringing something that appears to be a weapon to our school, yet we're handing out fake guns for this program. Now, it seems to me that's a little bit of a mixed message there for kids, isn't it? The article goes on. Herman Barnett, director of Leviso's award-winning MSCC program, asked the public to give the students the benefit of the doubt. Quote, they don't look at it as getting ready for the Army, he says. They're just doing it for entertainment and fun. Farther on down the article, it says the MSCC and JROTC program, the Junior ROTC program, are funded by the Defense Department, which has a $3 billion annual recruitment budget. Recruitment officers roam high schools, promoting the image of a secure military career and enticing students with promises of money for college. So what do you think? You think we ought to be promoting this kind of thing in the school? I personally think it's a bad idea. We know that contributing to political parties is a profitable business for big corporations. One of the best examples is Halliburton contributing to the Republican Party and to Dick Cheney and to George W. Bush. Look at all the no-bid contracts they've managed to come up with in Iraq so far. All of the scandals over overbilling and overcharging that have never been answered, never been paid back, and they get a bonus for performance. And not only that, but they're proud of their record. But another recent story is the ruling that the tobacco companies are only going to have to pay $10 billion in reparations instead of the $130 billion that they were originally ordered to repay. Now, that's a pretty fair profit on the $54 million that they've made in political contributions over the last 10 years. 75% of that was to the Republican Party. And, of course, Enron was a huge contributor to the Republican Party and to George W. Bush and Dick Cheney. And the Bush administration allowed them to rape, plunder, and pillage in California with all their energy scams for years. Refused to do anything about it. And, of course, you heard the triumphal phone calls of the energy brokers laughing about how much money they'd stolen from little old grandmothers in California. I mean, these guys aren't just smug, they're triumphal. You know, it used to be that if you were going to buy political influence, you had to be a little bit careful about letting people know that that's what was going on, but anymore, if they're able to buy a political party or a candidate or something like that, they come walking into town like Caesar entering Rome. These guys are so convinced now that they can't be stopped, that they're willing to get up in front of television cameras and brag about how they've taken over. They spend, they're completely convinced that what they're doing is right. And, of course, it is right for them. They don't have any concerns for working people, not whatsoever. Working people are an annoyance. And, you know, you might ask why things have gotten this way at this particular time, but, you know, back when the Soviet Union existed and communism was supposedly a real threat to this country, they knew that things like Social Security and unions and things like that were relief valves that kept people from fighting for more socialist policies. So they kept them in place, much as they hated them, And until finally the Soviet Union fell, they've got the unions beat down to a bloody pulp that can hardly get up off the floor anymore. So they're feeling like there's no restraints, that they can go ahead and do whatever they want because the competition has been beaten. And without any restraint, they're pursuing policies of full bloody war on the working class of this nation and actually the working class of the world. Somehow they think they have no competition. But take a look at Venezuela and the Bolivarian revolution that's going on there, and have a look at Bolivia. If people are determined enough and sick and tired enough, they can put a stop to it. And that's what's got to come before we see any improvement in our situation. Business arrangements where you don't have to pay your workers at all, but you can just make them work for their room and board. And if they try to escape, you can prevent that. You don't think Karl Rove and people like that have that in their mind? I don't know. I've seen no limit yet to their depravity. Selling everything from luxury cars to suppositories is what Madison Avenue does. They do their job very well, making billions and billions for themselves and their clients. They also understand that selling the product is half the job. The other big job for Madison Avenue and the entire money industrial complex is maintaining an environment where people are insecure enough to need artificial eyes, hair, breasts, tattoos, etc. in order to fit in. How do they create a demand for a product with no organic value? The easiest way to create need is to play on the fears we all have about measuring up to community standards. Create an artificial winner and make it clear that not being this winner means being a loser. Charles Dickens made his career by illustrating the plight of society's losers and the abuse that was heaped on them by the elite. Today, his graphic images of arrogance and corruption and the misery of the poor have been twisted to portray an arrogant elite as deserving winners, while all those pitiful losers have somehow earned their fate. Let's take a look at that. Let's take a transparency here and let's sketch out a recent automobile ad. The ad begins with mean, dark, empty streets. Trash blows in the wind past the camera. Suddenly a car speeds into view, stage left, and approaches our vantage point. As it nears, they switch to slow motion, and inside the car we see four young, beautiful people. The interior light is on. Their heads bob in time to the soundtrack of the ad. They're hip, well-dressed, and aloof. They're on the same wavelength so that they need not speak to each other. They just smile and give each other slow cat eye kisses. Aristocrats out for a drive. After a long, slow look at the car and its occupants, we switch back to real time and the car speeds off into the darkness, leaving trash swirling in the backdraft. The message is clear. Where winners belong is in that car. Inside is safe, inside is hip, inside is above the trash on the street. Outside is where you do not want to be. Outside is cold, outside is hungry, outside is trash. Aristocrats run down trash without pause on these dark streets. Aristocrats don't need to care about running down trash. Now let's take this transparency we just made and laid over scenes from Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities. As you can see, it's a pretty good fit. The costumes are radically different, the French aristocracy tending to wigs and lace and feathers, but they're still hip, well-dressed, and on the same wavelength. Those same slow cat eye kisses are there. The carriage is sleek and shiny, racing through the streets. The streets are littered with throwaway humanity, the trash alluded to but not shown in the 21st century ad. People scramble to get out of the way of the speeding horses, but sometimes one of the slower ones is caught and run down by the elite. In France, 1790-91, aristocrats need not care if they ran somebody down. They were aloof, immune from responsibility for their carelessness. A scream, a thump, a bump meant little to them as they raced from one decadence to another at the expense of that blizzard of flotsam and jetsam blowing in the backdraft of their speeding carriages. Here's where our comparison starts to fall apart. Today, the poor have trial lawyers to sue the elite for damages. Even if they don't have the money, they can hire one thanks to the contingency fee arrangement. In the case of gross misconduct, there are class action lawsuits to protect the poor from arrogant aristocrats. Well, that was before George Bush and the Republicans passed tort reform, which limits individual suits against elite corporate aristocrats. So now I guess there isn't any protections. It took them a lot of years and a lot of skill to sell that suppository. You've been listening to The Labor News with Glenn Lang. If you like what you hear, you can send a check made out to KITR to KITR, P.O. Box 456, Kettle Falls, Washington, 99141. The Labor News theme song is The Return of Coxey's Army by Eddie Starr. Thanks, Eddie.